Well, since we're just back from the feast, one of the questions that has to always be asked at the feast is, why are we here? Mr. Sandilands, in his opening night sermon, certainly kept that tradition alive and talked about that, asked that question. But since we're back, I want to turn that question around just a little bit and ask this question. And the question is, why were we there? Why were we there? Now, this was my 50th, and my wife's, our 50th feast. How many had 50 feasts there? Yeah. And he doesn't really count because he started when he was 2 years old or something. How about 40? Okay, we got a lot of 40s in here. How about at least 30? That's some more. So we look around, how about 20? Yeah, so the vast majority is 30 or more feasts. Now, after you've been to 30 Feasts of Tabernacles, do you really need another feast? After all, are you really going to hear anything that you haven't heard before? You know, what's with God? Shouldn't there be at some point you say, okay, congratulations, you got your 50th feast in, now you can just kick back and relax. But he doesn't say that, does he? As a matter of fact, if we look at the scripture again, this was, I believe this was used by Mr. Sandilands, in Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 25, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Now, so here this says that we need to get together. And not just so we can learn a few more scriptures and hear another inspiring sermon or something. Matter of fact, doesn't even mention this, that part, in this particular verse. But it's the getting ourselves together as we do every Sabbath. And, of course, this was not referring specifically about the Feast of Tabernacles, but all the services we have throughout the year and how important that is. And so you get kind of exhausted and so forth at the feast, and your mind can kind of deaden, and you can say, whew, when can we stop? Well, the Bible tells us when we can stop. In Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 13, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature and the fullness of Christ. So there it is. Once we reach perfection, we won't really need the feast anymore, will we? Something will change then. Matter of fact, at that point, God will change us and we'll join his family. And we'll be in an entirely different environment for all eternity. But, so as soon as you reach perfection, then you can say, okay, I've got it. But, you know, the problem is some people kind of think they've got it all figured out. And they just kind of stop. Sometimes they just stop attending. Say, oh boy, I'm just tired of this. They kind of keep their faiths kind of, you know, they say, yes, I believe in God, I believe in the Bible, but they don't do anything anymore. They don't go to services. And when that starts happening, and I know a few like that, they gradually change in the wrong direction, and they kind of drift away from God, and it's sad. But we go to the feast as we go into services every day. In summary, we want to learn God's way, and we want to grow. So the question is, are we growing? Are we really going? Here we're coming kind of a dead period now. So the long winter before the spring holy days, and we need to keep coming back to that question about growth. Are we growing? And I've noticed when I was, you know, I've been giving all these sermons about the brain, and I've gone through, read a number of books and gathered a lot of scientific information to give to you over the past few months. But one thing that along the way, I kind of collected some little, you might say, tidbits that I thought would be good to put together in a sermon. And the sermon is entitled, Myths That Hinder Our Growth. Myths That Hinder Our Growth. And so, you know, so I ran across some of these things, that kind of common things that people believe that are basically myths. Now, to get into this, I want to kind of do a quick review. We do have a few visitors who I'll have to cover all, I don't know, whatever it is, 10 sermons that I've given on the brain and the mind, how it works. I've got to do that in a minute. But that's okay. I can catch you up real quick. But one of the things, the big thing about the brain, and this which absolutely astounds and baffles scientists, is the parallel processing of the brain. And the computers are a good analysis. You have a group of computers that are all running simultaneously, and that's called parallel processing, and that's what supercomputers are. There may be 1,000 computers running simultaneously. What scientists can't figure out is how to efficiently get them to communicate with each other as they're running. Because, you know, your little computer that you've got in your pocket, which is your cell phone, you know, it does things one step at a time, single processing. But our brains are absolutely astounding at parallel processing. Scientists can see it working and see which parts of the brain are firing simultaneously, but they can't figure out how the brain does it. It's a mystery. But if we look at some of the things that science has learned, they've been able to measure down to neurons, how long it takes neurons to load and fire off and route information to another neuron. And what they've determined that it's about 3 to 15 cycles per second is the rate that the brain operates. Now, this is why when we're getting to an analytical mode, it's kind of slow, because we're going step by step, and the brain doesn't act that fast. Now, you take a computer, it may do hundreds of thousands of of these steps per second. And our brain is very slow, but it compensates for that because there's so many things going on at one time. The brain uses what scientists like to refer to as a mapping process. And it's not exactly like a roadmap, but it's more like thinking of things in terms of layers, you know, parallel processing layers. This is what they're thinking about. And take, for example, how we determine colors. Now, I've talked to you before about the brain and our everything we see goes back here to the back of our brain, and then it kind of fans out, and there's like 60 visual parts of the brain. They put V1, V2, V3, V4, and for example, in region V4. There's some modules, and they call them globs. Little globs, that's what they call them. They're about a millimeter in size, you know, about that big, a millimeter in size. And each of these globs has a job to do. And the job is to identify the color in a certain small space of your vision. You know, so you're looking up here, And how many different shades of colors do you suppose you're looking at in any one time? You know, hundreds, maybe 1,000. I mean, there's so many different shades and so forth. Well, there's a glob that will take, you know, maybe the tip of my nose. You're looking at me. And there's one glob that's focused on the tip of my nose. And it's telling your brain what the color of that is as compared to what the color of my ear is or my hair. And so there's a mass of these globs. And each one is covering a little teeny bit of the spectrum that you're looking at. So we don't sweep across to see. We see like that because of all these things that scientists call globs. But they're just a small collection of neurons that have been designed to overlay each other, communicate with each other, so we see the full picture. We see vivid color. And we see it all instantly. You know, some of you may not remember, back in the pre-digital days, I would do would be doing experience or making presentations, and I'd want to take something off a television screen. If you set up a camera back in those days and try to take a picture off of something on a TV screen, back in those days, it was a sweep. And it was so fast that your eye could not see it. But when you snap a picture, it would catch in the middle of the sweep, and there'd be kind of a line across the picture. But we don't sweep. We see it all one time, at one time, kind of like digital, the way things are today when every pixel is fired at the same time. So there's no sweeping there, but we have all this stuff going on in our brains, but certain things can't be parallel processed. Like if you're doing mathematical steps, you got to multiply by this, then take the result and divide by that, and then take the result of that and square it, and then you got to take it and integrate it over the range of 10 to 15 and then do this and that and the other. And those things are sequenced, so those are hard to parallel. A few people, savants, have a brain wired that they can even do that, which, of course, that's very unusual. So the brain uses this mapping process, and there's almost an infinite number of these neural networks that are parallelized. I'm not sure that's a word, but you know what I'm trying to say there. And so our mind is chock full of these things, all taking, firing off and taking action at any given time. And so any function that can be resolved in parallel structures or maps will be done efficiently and quickly. And scientists wish they could figure out exactly how God made that work, because they'd like to do the same thing with their computers. I showed you this image of the brain, which shows what I was talking about, the occipital lobe there in the back of the brain. And if you're learning something, then there's this dorsal vision zone that heads up into the parietal lobe and to the frontal cortex. This is upper part is more the analytical part, you know, where you do the math, where you, if you're learning to read, that's the part of the brain that's firing off. But once you've learned to read and it becomes automatic, then all that information kicks down here towards the temporal lobe and the under part of the brain, the underbelly of the brain. And that's the part of the brain where everything is intuitive. It just happens. When you see a face, you don't say, well, let's see. That face looks very familiar. Where have I seen that? And you start thinking and running through. No, you see Rogers McKinney's face, and you'll never forget that face, and you just know it. That's Roger McKinney. Yeah, but you don't have to think. It just pops into your mind. But then sometimes, and that's because you've got some layers there. You got some maps in there. I've got a map in my brain. I wish I could get rid of it. Roger McKinney's face. Sorry, Roger. I'm just kidding. You know that. But we've got all these little maps, you know, these little groups of neurons that are triggering everything in our mind so that we can function and we can operate. I was filling up at the gas station yesterday, and a woman pulled up, and she wanted to know where the government office of wildlife and fisheries and that sort of thing. There's an office over in the general area where I live, and I'd seen it before, but I couldn't pull it up. You know, it was just I knew what she was talking about, I knew kind of where it was, but I couldn't remember enough of the details to tell her. And so I said, "Let me think for a minute. Let me think. Let's see. It's down Perkins Road. Let's see where is it." And then the things began coming back. But see, I was in an analytical mode. You know, if I really had something I'd gone too often, I'd say, "Oh yeah, you go down three blocks, you turn right, then you go left, and so forth." But I had to, I had to think, I had to analyze to bring it up, and so that's the two different parts of our brain. And so this dorsal stream kicks things up to where we have to reason and think, and that's slow. And the ventral path, that's instant. That's things are just happening then. It's essentially unconscious. Okay, so with that background, let me get into the first myth here. The myth is it's harder for older people to learn new things. Now, when I'm talking about these myths, there are exceptions. Obviously, if you've got some kind of brain injury or some kind of a disease of the brain and it's caused senility or Alzheimer's or some kind of different problems like that, then yes, then that's not a myth. In that case, you do have problems learning new things. But for most of us, as we get older and our minds stay reasonably healthy, we may forget a little bit more from time to time. But, it's a myth that it's harder for older people to learn new things. I see this all the time. I'll give you another example. A month or so ago, our refrigerator, or actually the freezer of our refrigerator, started leaking. Water started pooling up. And we checked it out, and there's a bunch of ice down in the bottom of the freezer. And it's one of these freezers on the bottom of the refrigerator that pulls out like a drawer. And I thought, well, maybe I just need to clean out the ice and it'll be okay. But then a week later, it's leaking again. And so we called a repairman to come and look at it. Repairman came in, he looked at it, he pulled the drawer open a few times, said, "Ah, I see your problem. There's ice on these runners that the drawer sits on. Just have to put some oil on there. Squirt, 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 squirt. Don't worry, your problems are open." And he left. All right, a week later, the water's coming out again. And after continuing problems, we called another repairman. That repairman came in, had a completely different attitude. He knew some things that apparently this first person didn't. This first person didn't know his refrigerators very well and was just kind of guessing. This guy said, "Oh, yeah." First thing he did is he pulled the refrigerator out, got around the back, and started taking the back off. And he messed around for a few minutes, said, "Here it is." And he pulled out a little plug-like thing that was stopped up. Said, "This has gotten stopped up, and there's a little flap on it, and sometimes that flap gets jammed. Best thing to do is just take it out completely. Then you won't have to worry about the flap getting stuck anymore." And he could have left it at that. He said, "But what you've got to do now is you've got to take everything out of your refrigerator and defrost the whole refrigerator for 24 hours. He said, "Because there's a tube in there that, because of this blockage, is now frozen. And that's got to be thawed out. And then once that happens, you should be back to normal operation." But see, but he just saw all this. It's not like he was looking in a book or anything. He just knew these kind of things. Some things we know, and some things we don't know. And it's a mystery to us, and we're trying to figure them out. Now, when we talk about learning, see, the way we learn is we built up these maps. From childhood, we built up these maps. From the time we learned to read to when we studied chemistry, physics, math, English, all these maps have been built up. And that's what's going on. So a lot of things are intuitive that we just know. You know, we just know the capital of France. Why? Somewhere along the way, there's a little module in there, maybe a little glob or something, that still there and ready. Whenever we want to know about France, whoop, the capital just pops into our head. And, you know, the word Paris is just there. It's not like you have to think about it. But same thing with reading. I spent some time on a sermon not long ago talking about when we we're starting to learn to read, all the action is up in this frontal cortex. Once we become seasoned readers, it just happens. And that this part doesn't fire anymore, but the under part of the brain starts firing up because that's where the temporal lobe area, where everything is just kind of automatic. But suppose the whoever invented writing decided to, rather than writing from left to right in rows, I don't like that. Let's write top to bottom in columns. Some languages you still write in rows, but you write from right to left in some languages. But suppose that had happened. Instead of in English, when you read a book, you'd read column, column, column. Well, you're good readers. That should be easy. So read this paragraph that I want you to, let me go through something here. I'm talking about how the thinking becomes automatic and the building the maps through the ventral system. And these maps, very, very specific. And so we have some reading maps in our mind. But I want you to read this this sentence that I'm going to show you, and it's in vertical columns from left to right, but you got to read it vertically. Finish yet? I'll read it for you. However, the human brain has the ability to change this collection of automatic operations. But you probably struggled trying to read that because you don't have those maps to think vertically instead of horizontally. But I do. You see how fast I read that? That's because I wrote it out horizontally right there on my notes. But, you know, one thing I did notice, I've kind of gone through this several times, and what I did notice that I got better at reading vertical every time I looked at that thing. And, so my mind was already starting to create something, thinking, man, this nut is going to start reading everything vertical, and I've got to make some changes here. But that's the kind of, that's the way our mind has been trained in certain ways. And we're real experts in those things. Like, we're real experts in reading horizontally. We're not so hot in reading vertically. And we can look at a lot of things like that. But obviously, even reading is not as automatic as you think. But let's look at Titus 2 in verse 6 through 8. Again, I'm stealing a scripture from Mr. Sanderlands that he used at the feast. It's his, and I'll give him credit for it, but I'm going to borrow it for a minute here. Titus 2, verses 6 through 8, likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded. So he's talking about young men who are still forming things spiritually. It says, exhort young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. Now, this is what struck me about this, because I already had a lot of the sermon prepared when I was at the feast. This word pattern of good works, that's what the brain does. It establishes these neural patterns that they're overlaid so that everything can parallel process. And, I didn't know that Paul was such a neuroscientist, but he was inspired. And God is a pretty good neuroscientist. And so he inspired this, and and that's what we're building up in our minds, a patterns related to good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of us. But yeah, that's exactly what Paul is talking about. You know, the maps are basically these brain patterns. You know, so how do we learn? Now, there's two types of learning. Learning a physical skill and mentally learning concepts. But they're pretty similar in terms of how the brain operates. But I want to use a simple example here. And I ask you the question, how fast can you type? That's just a simple physical skill. And one of the most valuable courses I ever took in high school was my typing course. I learned to type in high school. And so it's been good ever since. I got up to a course of a semester. I got up to where I could type about 60 words a minute. And 60 words a minute is kind of average for a person that does much typing. They develop the skill. It gets up to about 60 words a minute. Now, in this era, we have a different kind of typist. You know, I use all the fingers. But the youngsters here, they often just use two, the thumbs, because they're texting all the time. Now, I don't know what the average speed of a good texter is, but I've watched a few texts, and man, those thumbs are flying, and they're texting stuff, and they're pretty fast. I don't know whether it's 60 words a minute or not, but they get so good at it that they're pretty, you know, they're pretty good. Me, I'm kind of dunk, because I don't do much texting. I do more type. Now, the keyboard is exactly the same, typist, but I can't fit all my fingers on there. I could beat them on texting, but that little keyboard is just too small. you know, it's whatever speed that you can type is probably not your maximum. You know, what science has found is that when you learn to type and you're using it regularly, your speed builds up to a certain level, and then it peaks out, and you're kind of there. 60 words. I've been typing for at least 50 years, pretty regularly in my work. I typed a lot and so forth, but I don't think I've ever gotten any faster. Once I reached a certain level, there I was. That was where I kind of peaked out at. You know, and I got there by practice. You know, when I was learning typing, I was taking that class 5 days a week, an hour a day, so I had to type for a whole semester, and I got up to 60. But then I didn't do much practicing anymore. I just typed whenever I needed to type. But in order to learn concepts as well as learn physical things, it takes a lot of meticulous practice to get to that certain level. You know, but so what happens once you get to a certain level, like when I type, I'm not really thinking too much. I'm just typing away, and I'm thinking about the meaning of what I'm trying to type more than the words themselves. You know, we start getting away from, I've got to type that, and you just starts flowing, you know, because you're not taking things fragmented. You're taking them in as a more of a global thought. You're thinking sentences instead of words when you type. So, why did my typing not keep improving? Why didn't it keep improving? Well, I want to address that and show you a graph, and this applies to typing, but it also applies to our spiritual growth, our spiritual learning, and how we grow. And on this graph, on the vertical scale, I'm going to show improvement in knowledge of God, so forth, or improvement in typing speed, if you want to look at something physical. And on the horizontal scale, effort. And so the graph looks something like this. And you improve pretty quickly. Then you begin to, the improvement kind of slows down, and it finally levels out at some level. And psychologist Mariano Sigmund calls this the okay threshold level. It's a point where, yeah, okay, it's okay. And you're happy with that, and you live with that. But up there somewhere, there is a maximum that is much higher than your okay level. So the difference between your okay level, the okay threshold, and the maximum, that gap is the gap in learning, is your gap in knowledge. Whether it's how to type, whether it's understanding God's word, there's a gap there. There's always a gap there. And the question is, how big is that gap? Now, the okay threshold, as I said, is a comfort zone in which we find a tacit balance between the desire to improve and the effort that it would require. I could probably get my typing up to 90 words a minute if I practice. But I don't need to get my typing up to 90 words a minute. So it's okay. It's an okay threshold. Now, if I was only typing 5 words a minute, I'd have to do something because that wouldn't work very well, see? But I'm not anywhere near my maximum. And then there's the complacency index, which is the ratio between the okay threshold and the maximum limit. In other words, it's how wide that gap is. If you're at your maximum limit, then that ratio is 1 or 100%. Now, I type about 60 words a minute. The record for typing is around 216 words a minute. Okay, so let's assume I could reach that level if I just spent all my time just trying to type faster. If that's my maximum, 216, I'm typing at 60. Well, 60 over 216, that comes out to be about 28%. So my complacency index is 28% when it comes to typing. And that's not particularly good. That's pretty low. And you want it to be up to 70%, 80%, 90%. In other words, we want it to be 100% in terms of spiritual things, in terms of our spiritual growth. So that's the goal, to reach 100%. But just taking that example, we're a long way off from that, most of us, in terms of physical things that we do. But it's okay. We don't really need to do more. But God says in his word, yes, we do. And so when we leave the feast, or when we were at the feast, they're related to this myth of, I'm getting so old, I don't really need it. You kind of relax. You get complacent. And so you need to start asking yourself, what's your complacency index? 28%? 50%? What is it? Look at Zephaniah chapter 1. Read verses 7 through 10 here. Zephaniah prophesied in the period of Josiah, which was around 639 to 608. Now, these are approximate dates here. But it was in that 608 was when the Babylonians first kind of moved some armies into Judah and was beginning of the fall of Jerusalem. And so it's in that period leading up to the collapse of Judea and Jerusalem. But look what he says here. He says, "Be silent in the presence of the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is at hand. For the Lord has prepared a sacrifice. He has invited guests. And it shall be in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princesses and the king's children and all such that are clothed with foreign apparel." Now, so clearly he's talking about the coming fall of Jerusalem and Judea and the captivity. And, of course, this is a type to other things in modern times that we look to. But specifically, it's referring to that time. But notice he's talking about the leadership here, the princes, the king's children. In the same day, I will punish all those who leap over the threshold. That's apparently some kind of pagan thing related to some pagan religion. Who fill their master's houses with violence and deceit. And there shall be on that day, says the Lord, the sound of a mournful cry from the fish gate, a wailing from the second quarter, a loud crashing from the hills. Of course, it's talking about different parts of the Jerusalem and the surrounding area. And then in verses 11 and 12 of Zephaniah 1, well, you inhabitants of Maktesh, which is apparently a marketplace in Jerusalem, for all the merchant people are cut down, all those who handle money are cut off, and it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish the men who are settled in complacency, who say in their own heart, the Lord will not do good or he will not do evil. Now think about that for a minute. God is saying, what was the problem with Judah? They got so complacent. They just accepted, yeah, there's a God. We got his Bible. We got the temple. Yeah, what can go wrong? What can go wrong? We're good. You know, the Lord, he's just out there somewhere. He's not hurting us too much. He's not doing too much good. Yeah, but we're getting along, you know, that kind of thing. Very complacent attitude. It was what the criticism here was of Judah. Now, of course, he's talking about his people. That same applies to us. We are his people. Is he going around with a lamp searching out the complacent? Are we complacent? In Isaiah. No, we don't have any British here with us today, so won't have to say that. Love that accent, Mr. Hawkins. Those of you who weren't in Orange Beach, Mr. Hawkins gave a Bible study and a sermon. He's got that British accent to the fullest, and you know who knows what he said. I just listening to the accent. But in Isaiah 32, verses 9 through 11. And this is another interesting scripture. And it's about time that God said, you women have some responsibility too. The whole Bible is about men who have messed up. The whole Bible pretty much is about men who have messed up. Every now and then some woman comes along and saves the day. But here he says, rise up you women who are at ease. Hear my voice, you complacent daughters. Give ear to my speech. In a year and some days, you will be troubled, you complacent women, for the vintage will fail, the gathering will not come. Tremble, you women who are at ease. Be troubled, you complacent ones. Strip yourselves, make yourselves bare, and gird sackcloth on your waist. Now, Isaiah was prophesying during the period that covered the fall of northern Israel. A period from about 745 to about 695. Israel fell around 734. So he was prophesying during northern Israel's destruction. But it's talking to both of us, men and women. This complacency was a major problem. They thought they were doing okay. They weren't even coming close. Their complacency index must have been maybe 5% at best. And they thought they were up with maybe an 80% complacency index. In Proverbs 1 and verse 32, for the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. Complacency brings destruction. In Proverbs 3 and verses 1 and 2, my son, do not forget my law. Let your heart keep my commands for the length of your days and long life and peace they will add to you. And he said, look, this is not a young man's game. This is an old man's game. We need to understand that it's a myth if you think, hey, I'm just too old to really get into studying and learning and proving and growing and so forth. You know, I'm peaked out. Problem is, you think you're peaked out at 90% complacency index, and you're probably down at 40% if you're thinking that way. So that's the problem. I think, have you ever seen a complacent child? Mm-hmm. Or even a complacent young adult? They always want to do, they're always learning new things and so forth. But then us old people, we can very easily become complacent, can't we? Proverbs 3 and verse 13 through 16. Happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding, for her proceeds and are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things that you may desire cannot compare with her. Length of days is in her right hand, and her left hand is riches and honor. So again, age is not the problem. Our complacency is the problem. You think you can't learn because you're getting old? Forget about it. It's a myth. Myth two that I want to talk about. And this one will take a little explanation. The more you pay attention, the more you learn. That's a myth, according to the scientists, and I'll explain why they say so. Now, again, there's certain conditions that apply to this, but let me give you the exception first. With two people who have equal prior knowledge, then those who pay attention do achieve greater results. So if you're on equal footing with somebody else in terms of what you already know, and then you're being taught additional information, then the more you pay attention, the better the achievements will be. But those with less prior knowledge but who pay more attention learn less. So what's going on here? Now, they do so many fun things with brains. I kind of wish I'd gone into neuroscience and I could wire people up and see their brains firing away and that sort of thing. That would have been fun. Instead, I just broke beams and caused explosions as structures collapsed and things like that in my lab. But that would have been more fun, I think. But what they did is they took a learning situation, a teacher and the learner, and they wired his brain up so they could see what all was firing. And I've mentioned this to you in other sermons. Our intuitive mind is pretty much effortless. We just know things. It doesn't take any work. Our analytical mind, that takes work. If you're distracted when you're trying to multiply out a series of numbers, you'll mess up. But if you're in that intuitive mode of just telling somebody directions, no matter what's going on around you, it's no problem. It's intuitive. And so the effort of the brain is related to this top part, this analytical part. And so they say, well, what's firing? And so you got two people, one has more background knowledge than the other, and they're both being taught this information. So the person with less knowledge, he's focusing more on the details, you know, the facts, learning fact A, fact B, and fact C, and right taking the notes and getting everything down and so forth. Whereas the person that has a little better background in this area is able to think less analytically and more intuitively, and think more in terms of pulling issues and facts together. And so what they found is that they would give these people, after they go through the learning lesson and they've been wired up and they've been monitored, they'll give them a test and see whether they pass the test on the material. And what they found is they could predict who was going to pass the test and who was going to fail the test by how much was going on up here as compared to underneath. They could predict who was going to be successful in passing the test. Because when you're in that effort mode, you're not learning as much as if your intuitive part is engaged also. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. And so those with less knowledge follow procedure step by step, whereas those with prior knowledge can concentrate on less on the details and more on the total concept. You know, it's kind of like memorizing the Ten Commandments versus learning the spiritual depth of the Ten Commandments. Entirely two different things. But somebody didn't know the Ten Commandments, and I start preaching on the Ten Commandments and start talking about things, that person might be writing down the Ten Commandments while somebody that already knew the Ten Commandments are thinking about what I'm really saying. You know, that it's not that there's depth and there's spiritual, there's not just physical, but the spirit, you know, things of that nature. They would see more of that more quickly and learn more. So the mental effort is inversely related to prior knowledge. It doesn't take as much effort. Your intuitive brain is pretty much effortless, and it kicks in more. All right, so in order to learn concepts, meticulous practice is required, just as I've said before, just like learning to type. The more prior knowledge you have, the less effort is required. And the less effort that is required, the higher complacency index you're going to have, because you'll be going learning deeper, more meaningful concepts, because you're not in the fact mode, you're in the understanding mode. And so that's what that's meant by the more you pay attention, the less you learn. You need more in the intuitive part of your mind to learn faster and more effectively than if you're having to use your analytical mind. Look at Hebrews 5, verses 12 through 14. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you have come to need milk, not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are full of age. So here we go back to age. Yeah, age, you should be learning more as you get older, not less. That is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. So you see what he's saying there? He's saying we're down in the intuitive part of the mind where the senses are, where things are just intuitive, things you just know because you've taught them and they've landed there. They're no longer... You have to think about it. They're automatic. And so, you know, take note-taking, for example. Most people take notes at services. And you can take very meticulous notes and get every scripture and write down the gist of it and so forth. But sometimes, and I do this, sometimes I get so caught up in that I really kind of lose track of the real meaning of what's being said. I have to back off a little bit. Say, wait a minute, let me get the bigger picture here. So I quit taking so many notes. And sometimes I won't take a single note in a sermon because I know the basic scriptures that are being used. And so I don't have to do all that. And I can kind of focus on the big picture of what the person is trying to teach us. And so I go both ways, depending on the type of sermon it is. You know, that's really a more effective way of learning if you balance out how much notes you're taking and how much you're thinking about the depth of what is being said. Okay, myth three. Our temperament is genetic and cannot really change. A lot of people think that. Matter of fact, I'll give you an example, a football example. It was several years ago, the Seattle Seahawks were playing, not sure whether it may have been the Super Bowl, the year they won the Super Bowl. It may have been an earlier playoff game. I don't remember which. I don't remember exactly who they were playing. But they have had a defensive back into the game. The other team was driving against the Seahawks. They threw a pass into the end zone. As I think it was maybe fourth down or time was expiring. I don't remember exactly the details. So a pass into the end zone. And this defensive back for the Seahawks jumped up, knocked the ball away. That was the game. Seahawks won the game. And, you know, they have those sideline reporters. And so the time ran out. The game was over when that happened because there's just a few seconds left. Sideline reporter was right there, stuck a phone, microphone in front of Richard Sherman, was the defensive back. And he was fired up, and he started talking about the receiver. He said, he's no good. They should never have passed over here. That guy's terrible. He shouldn't even be in this league. I'm just spouting off like that. And you know, kind of, I'm the greatest. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Muhammad Ali in the way he was, you know. And it was really a show that he put on. But this was, you know, maybe 15, 20 seconds after it happened, because the game had ended, and that sideline reporter was right there. Well, a little bit later in doing the interviews, he calmed down a little bit, and they interviewed him again. And he said, well, I can't retract anything I said. Yeah, I was excited, but that's the way I am, and I can't change myself. That's what struck. That's why I remember that. He said, hey, I can't change. And of course, then he was talking about his temperament. He was talking about he couldn't change his temperament. And that's what a lot of people believe. Now, back in the middle of the last century, a researcher by the name of Stella Chess and her husband conducted a study into the science of personality. And what they did is they measured 9 traits of temperament. They took 9 traits of temperament, and they measured these temperaments in people from the time they were born through adulthood. A long, massive study, really a landmark study. And others have done followed up with similar studies since, came up with the same results. But let me just list the temperaments that they were looking at. These were the temperaments. Their activity levels and types, just what, you know, how active they were and whether they were very inactive people or what kind of things they did, that sort of thing. The degree, their health, their diet, the sleeping habits, just how healthy they basically took care of themselves. Their willingness to try something new. You know, this whole idea of, oh, let's go do this. I've never skied before. Let's go skiing and things like that. You know, trying something new. Taking a baby up to the lectern in the middle of a sermonette, that was something new. So those of you who weren't in Orange Beach don't know what I'm talking about. But, you know, but they measured that kind, those kind of traits, the adaptability to changes in environment, their sensitivity. Some people are very sensitive. Some people, don't make a difference what happens to them, that they don't care. Everything just rolls off their back. You can't insult them. So there's a big variety there. The intensity and energy levels of their responses, just how much enthusiasm they have, the general mood, happy, sad, mean, you know, that sort of thing. The degree of distraction, do they focus easily or are they easily distracted? And their persistence. You know, so they trace these attributes from birth through adulthood to see what happened. Now, what happened? Well, several things, and this is a fairly obvious one. The most decisive factor in those temperament aspects is the home the child grew up in. That was a big factor. But of the variance in temperament, they concluded that about somewhere between 20 and 60% is explained by genetics, which means that the rest, half or a little more, is related to nurture. You know, so we've heard that before, half nature, half nurture kind of thing. No big surprise there. But what was interesting is that from birth through adulthood, the traits were surprisingly consistent. People didn't change much from their early years. They were pretty much the same over their lifetime in terms of temper. They were like that Richard Sherman. I can't change, he said. And that's what kind of people see, they're not changing much. Look at Ephesians 4, verses 17 through 19. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardening of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over to licentiousness, to the work to work all uncleanliness with greediness. You know, so, yeah, there's people that just, that's the way they are. But then continue on in verse 20. But you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man, which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lust, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in righteousness and truth and holiness. So God says, this is a myth that you can't change your temperament. God says, do exactly that. Change. But we like to think, yeah, well, that's just kind of the way I am. Yeah, boy, I had bad genes, and how can, what can I do about that? No, God says, yeah, you can do a lot about that. Let's go back and look at that list again. There are activity levels, types. God is asking us to change all of these things from what we are, really. You know, in terms of your activity levels, serving God, doing the work, that's a big change for all of us. You know, the God's health laws, was that a big change? Big change for me. The willingness to try something new, that's talking about change. Try something new. Try God's way. That's a big change in temperament. Their adaptability to change in the environment. You know, as Paul said, I've learned in whatever way, in whatever state I am, to be content. In Philippians 4:1. You know, that adaptability to how you find yourself. Yeah, I said, yeah, that's the way you've got to be. Their sensitivity. Boy, that's a big one. Some people just seem to be so sensitive, and they just can't change it, and they can't loosen up and, you know, not be offended at every single look that somebody gives you, kind of thing. You know, that's what love is all about. Loving others is putting them first. Okay, so they insulted me. Okay, well, they probably got problems. They're my brother, and I'm not going to let that bother me. You know, that kind of attitude. But some people just can't do that. They can't make that kind of change. The intensity and energy level that we have, you know, whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Ecclesiastes 9:10, that's what God tells us. If you don't have energy, you better get some. Of course, if you're physically impaired, that's one thing. But most of us aren't to that point yet. You know, the general mood, you know, joy, the degree of distraction, focus is what God expects us to do. And not get distracted by the world, mainly. And, of course, persistence, perseverance. Now, God expects all these temperaments, that characteristic, he expects us to change every single one of them to more fully serve God. So, yes, we can change. Which brings me to my last myth here, myth 4, that natural talent is innate and always limits what we can accomplish. Scientists disagree with that. I've talked about the 10,000-hour rule some in other sermons. But basically, science says if you really practice hard for 10,000 hours in some skill, you're going to be pretty good at it. That it's the practice. Now, Mr. Sanderlands was talking about the pianist in special music. I don't know who that was, but wasn't she also playing several of the just the song service? She was fantastic. And just, you know, usually during the song service, I don't pay much attention to the piano. It's there, you know, it's kind of keeping you in rhythm and so forth. But I sometimes when she was playing, I stopped singing and just started listening to her, because she was putting things in those songs that I had never heard in those songs. They were beautiful. Now, I guarantee you, she just wasn't born that way. That she's probably, I'm guessing, spent her whole life dedicated to the pen. Do you know her? That's probably the case then, that she was dedicated to that. You know, we are dedicating ourselves to something, not to playing the piano, but to living God's way. And that's what we're practicing. Now, what they found, they've done studies where they look at youngsters, preschool, early years of school, try to predict which one of these are going to be the superstars, the geniuses, the most successful. They can't do it. Cannot do it. Why? Because they don't know which ones are going to put the effort in, put the practice in. You know, natural talent just doesn't get it. Now, it helps. You know, it's very sad in my case. I was right on the verge of being a big star in the National Basketball Association. Right on the verge. But I stopped growing at 6 feet, and I really needed to be about 7. The genes got me on that one. But, you know, so sometimes the genes will get you. But you think Michael Jordan didn't practice? He was known for his intensity in basketball practices. He'd get in fights with his teammates. That's how hard he practiced. You know, it's not the natural talent so much as the effort you put in developing that talent. And of course, in physical things, that sometimes the genes play into it, but not so much in mental things. You know, learning how to do something skillfully does not require improving the cerebral machinery. It requires replacing it with new mechanisms. You might say, you know, let me stand up here and talk about evolution. It might scare you for a minute. But our brains, they kind of evolve in that they reconnect, they break up some circuits that they're not using and reconnect them in other ways. As we grow and so forth, our brain is changing and reconnecting and forming new patterns, new maps. And that's called growth, not really evolving, but it's growth. And that's what's going on. And genetics in general are a minor limit. You know, there's 5'8" basketball players. It was one that was just traded from the Celtics. I forget his name now. But anyway, he was 5'8" or 5'9". He was just traded from the Celtics to the Cavaliers. He was an all-star. You know, he only came up to my nose. So maybe I wouldn't have been an NBA player in any case. But look at Romans 15, verse 4. For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we should, through patience, and my margin says perseverance, and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. Yeah, we don't need the natural talent to understand God's way. We do need certain things. We need His Holy Spirit. We need to be practicing. We need to be putting our whole heart into it. John 7 and verse 14 through 17. Now, about the middle of the feast, and this was a Feast of Tabernacles, by the way, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, "How does this man know letters, having never studied?" They marveled. That just didn't happen. It's like, this guy is a natural. There's a baseball movie about the natural, and because he just had these great skills. He was just a natural. And there really aren't naturals, hardly ever. You know, every now and then, there maybe is an exception to that. And basically, there aren't naturals. They're people that really, really work hard to achieve their goals and overcome their weaknesses, and their weaknesses become strengths. But they were astounded. Nobody does this unless they go to school with the priest and go through the priesthood. Who is this guy? He just comes in off the street and is teaching us. That's the power we have if we are applying ourselves and following Christ's example. Jesus answered them and said, "My doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone wants to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority." You know, a lot of people are being deceived in the world. We have the opportunity to come to really know God. But don't let any of these myths slow you down. There's nothing in your way, nothing in our way. As we come home from the feast, start facing and looking forward towards the spring holy days and the winter ahead, let's keep the momentum up. Let's grow. Let's become more Christ-like. Let's make that complacency index right up there towards 100% so we can be ready for God's kingdom.